It hasn't come as a surprise. We know we've had an incredibly busy winter period. And first and foremost, I wanted to acknowledge just the level of operational pressure that we have been under. It has been an incredibly difficult winter. So first and foremost, I did want to acknowledge that because I know our staff have had to work incredibly hard and it has been pressured. And I don't want to suggest that isn't the case. However, there are some facts in that statement which I would wish to challenge because they are not correct. And specifically, if I talk about the bed numbers first. So I think the statement suggests that bed numbers have reduced by 46% since Manx Care. So that is not the case. And we have shared that information with the medical staffing committee in an open and transparent way. There has been bed reductions over the last 5 years. As we have looked at where we need the beds or where the models of care has changed. So there has been a reduction of 46 beds over the course of the last 5 years. So that's 16% of our beds. And those have been across a number of areas. Some of it in our elective orthopaedic space, some of it in the reduction of the neonatal beds that we no longer need. Changes in our service delivery models. So, for example, we have intermediate care out in the community. So they are virtual ward beds. And we have also commissioned more beds in the community. So I think whilst I absolutely understand the pressure on hospital beds, Manx Care has a number of other beds across its system. And we are working towards transferring care into the communities. So the first thing I wanted to assure the public is that we have not taken out over 100 beds. It's much less than that. And I'm happy to provide the detail of those figures and indeed have provided those figures to the Medical Staffing Committee.
So they claim there's been a 46% decrease in capacity. You're saying now it's a 16%. Where's this disparity come from then? Why do you think there is confusion over that figure?
All I can think of is that when Nobles Hospital was originally built, I think there it was built to have over 300 beds. And I think over time there has been ward environments changed to different models. So for example, where we have the Scott Oncology Suite, that used to be a ward. And that ward has been converted into our chemotherapy and oncology unit, which doesn't have beds, but it has chairs. And so I think there are a few areas of the hospital where what used to be a ward is now a different area of frontline care delivery. Whilst I can only account for the bed reductions in the last 5 years, I suspect that that big number comes from decisions which have been taken over the last 20 years of Nobles being in operation.
One of the points that the committee makes is that by comparison, in terms of looking at other places and other places' bed numbers, we seem to be falling short. Would you agree with that comparison?
I think if you just look at the numbers per 1,000 population, clearly we are on the low side. But equally, what we have to recognise is that we've also we're delivering care in an integrated care system where we have a lot of beds outside of the hospital. But yes, the reality is we do have a lower number of beds per population than other countries. And so I don't think anyone is going to dispute that point. But it's very nuanced around how care is delivered. If I just talk about bed occupancy, because safe care is often measured in what's called bed occupancy levels. What you're aiming for, what good looks like, is a bed occupancy of around 85%. That's what would be recommended and is ideal for delivering safe and efficient care. And during the course of this year, our bed occupancy will be around 86.5%. So just over that, 90% is a sign of significant pressure. But of course, it does ebb and flow. We have in recent months and weeks, had days when our bed occupancy has been 90%. There is pressure in the system, but it is not continuous and sustained. We have had periods, but then it does drop down again. And at the moment, we have been doing a programme of ward reconfiguration. So over the last year, we have been changing some of our wards, relocating some of our wards and building additional facilities for us to have a sustainable model moving forward. And of course, that's happened at the worst possible time. We've had to do that work over the winter period, which has impacted on our ability to open additional capacity when we've been under pressure. And of course, we never anticipated we would need to move our Ramsey ward down to Nobles Hospital. That was unanticipated, unplanned, but an emergency response that we needed to do to ensure patient and staff safety. So none of these things are ideal. But despite that, we've absolutely attempted to make things as safe as we possibly can. And indeed, when we look into the next year, we will have commissioned more beds in the community. We will have expanded our intermediate care. We will have completed our ward reconfiguration, which gives us the elective surgical hub, our new stroke ward, and a clinical decision unit on ward two, which will help that flow out of the emergency department, which is another area of concern. Because again, that department is incredibly congested and seeing more patients than it was ever built for.
As you said there, none of those compounding factors are ideal. But what these doctors seem to be saying is that with the pressures around beds, with the pressures on the emergency department, I mean, they've gone as far as to say that it poses a direct risk to patients' lives. Would you agree with that? Could you agree with that statement?
No, I think we always focus on safety and we always staff up when we know we've got additional pressures. And we have put additional medical staff and nursing staff into those areas, reflecting the increased activity. So the number of consultants and senior doctors within the acute emergency pathway has increased from 2 to 5. We have put additional investment into our doctors in medicine specialties, working with the deanery. So I firmly believe we are still delivering safe care. We monitor that, but we do recognise that we have been under pressure and it's not ideal to care for patients in the emergency department for a long period of time. We absolutely know that is not ideal. But if a patient is waiting for a bed on one of our wards, they are nursed on a bed. So they're not on a trolley. They're not out in the waiting room. They are nursed on a bed. And there are comfort rounds to ensure they are getting ward-based care, albeit it's not in a ward environment. It is in the emergency department. But all steps are taken to make sure the care is appropriate. But I have to caveat that by saying none of this is how we would ideally wish for care to be delivered. We are responding to some real pressures. We need a bigger emergency department. We do need a clear pathway in the clinical decision unit to be available as quickly as possible. And we do need to make sure that as soon as our patients are medically optimised, they are able to leave hospital. And that's another area of focus, because we used to have very high numbers of delayed transfers of care. So people who are medically ready to leave hospital but waiting for something else, an assessment, financial assessment, families to choose their next location of care. And that used to be in the 20s, around 23 to 25 on average. And that is now in single figures, 4 or 5 patients at any one time. And that's the right thing for the patient, but it's also the right thing to ensure our hospital beds are used as effectively as possible.
Some of these people who are taking up bed spaces, and I'm loath to use the term bed blockers because it's quite derogatory. There is a jam, isn't there, in the system here?
There is. And we do know we have, you know, a higher elderly population, and we know that the patients who are coming into hospital are much sicker and have multiple comorbidities. There's a physical health issue often associated with a mental health issue, perhaps the dementia. And these are complex individuals whose pathway out of hospital is also complicated and needs a lot of support and a lot of social care support. And we do know that staying in hospital longer than needed is also bad in terms of clinical outcomes. So yes, that's why we've put the intermediate care service in place and also the new frailty service at the front door, so we can intercept and consider what might be an appropriate pathway for some of these patients. But yes, we work, you know, it's not just about Manx Care. We work in a complicated system where financial assessments need to take place, assessments. We work with independent sector homes. We definitely want to move to, and we will move to this quite quickly, what's called a discharge to assess model. It is not appropriate for financial assessments or other assessments around care or ongoing care to be undertaken in a hospital setting. It's the false environment for those assessments to take place. So what we need to be able to do is step those patients down out of an acute hospital bed into some other form of care whilst those assessments take place. And that's what we're doing. Part of our challenge has been we have not been able to shift enough resource into the community setting quickly enough to put the infrastructure in place to both prevent admissions, but also to support early discharge. But we're starting to see that shift now. Intermediate care has had a very positive impact since we put it in 2024. And we've got plans in our mandate and operating plan this year to further strengthen that, because we do need to make sure that our acute beds are being used appropriately.
The doctors have called for 50 additional inpatient beds, basically as a matter of urgency. Can you magic 50 beds up? What are the chances of them getting 50 additional inpatient beds this week?
So if we could magic up around sort of 100 nurses, and if we could magic up probably around 15 to 20 doctors, possibly. But we're talking several millions of pounds worth. It's over two wards, and we do need to think about what extra capacity is needed, but also where it's needed. And that doesn't necessarily correlate straight into putting two extra wards into a hospital. We do know it's pressured, and we do know when our ward reconfiguration programme is completed, we get some wards back. We do know when we are able to relocate Martin Ward back, that's another space back that could be used as a ward. But, you know, I can understand why the 50 is being asked for and why that number, but actually we're talking several millions and hundreds of staff.
Is this going to be a case of having to go back and ask for more money? Is there budget to help alleviate some of these problems? Financially, where are we at the moment?
Well, that is a discussion to be had. Certainly, they are aware of the pressures, because we speak daily about the pressures that we have. You know, they understand the pressure we have been under and our response to it. It is probably a question for the department to answer. I know the scrutiny on our expenditure is immense. It's daily. We're challenged on headcount. We're challenged on how we're spending the money. We're challenged on making sure our forecast and our outturn position is as low as possible, that our overspend is as low as possible. So it's very difficult to balance those two paradigms. And this is the sort of difficulty which is just part of being the chief executive of Manx Care. I have a duty and a responsibility to balance the budget, but primarily I have a responsibility for ensuring we deliver safe and effective care to the population that we serve. And sometimes you're in a difficult situation, but I would want to make sure that the public understand that we haven't taken beds out recklessly. They have all had an evidence base behind. We are planning carefully for the future and the different models of delivery of care, and doing that work. And some of the the additional budget that we will have received in this financial year moving forward will enable us to stabilise the position, put more beds in the community, more frailty pathways, and really deal with the level of demand that we are seeing. Some of the fundamental issues come back to the estate, because actually, even if we had 100 nurses, we don't have two more wards. We would have to go and secure some extra space or some modular wards landed on the car park in order to do that. You know, that's the reality, and that just isn't feasible. These are not easily solvable, and they need careful and thorough consideration. And and we'll continue to work with the department and government on what some of those solutions look like.
In the short term, is there anything that we can do just to take the pressure off these doctors?
That is around those discharge pathways. That is something we can do. We know there are patients who can be cared for outside of the hospital environment. And those doctors themselves are frustrated that those patients aren't moving to their next level of care as quickly as they can. So that's something we are doing, and that commissioning has already started, those extra beds out in the community. In addition, we want to be able to provide more of that intermediate care. We're putting frailty at the front door. So again, making sure we're only admitting those patients who really do need to come into hospital. We've had an incredibly, it's been a horrible winter, hasn't it? You know, weather-wise, it's been very cold, it's been very wet. We have seen high levels of acuity and some very, very poorly patients coming through. So it has absolutely been pressured. The clinical decisions unit will also help. So within the next 6 to 8 weeks, there are a number of new initiatives which will start to ease that pressure.
As well as highlighting the issue with the what they perceive to be the bed shortages, they have talked a lot about the impact that that's actually having on the doctors personally and how they feel that it's impairing their ability to practice, I guess. I mean, you're a human being. You must be quite moved by some of the comments that they've made. They've described it as moral injury.
And I acknowledge that, yes. I mean, we are all in the caring profession because we care. We care about people. It's fundamentally ingrained in us, and no one wants to be able to see suffering or not be able to do our very best job. You know, I talk about it a lot. I talk about it at the induction. We recognise the pressure that the NHS and health and care is under across the world does lead to people feeling that level of moral injury. I feel it. Me and my team feel it. I've got clinical background, as have many of my team. So I wouldn't ever want to not acknowledge. It's how we support and work together to resolve that, because fundamentally, health and care is a team sport. We all work together, and certainly me and my team often stay into the hospital very late into the evening to be able to support frontline teams to give that support. Even when we know some of the solutions that we would love to put in place, we can't. So yes, I acknowledge that in these roles, these very difficult roles, moral injury is something which people do experience. But that's where we want to support. That's where supervision speaking to us. One of my disappointments is that this was not brought to my attention, really. The chair of the medical staffing committee has not sat down with me. We are actively discussing all of these. We're discussing all of these solutions at board level. We know how important it is to get this right. And unfortunately, this isn't the way to do it. We all want to work together to deliver the best health and care for the island. And I'm very much part of that solution, as are my exec team and the wider board. We are absolutely listening, and we are trying to do as much as we can. But it's like you say, can I just magic up two wards? No. Who could? So we have to do things differently, and we have to work together.
Is there too many managers? Is there too many people who are being paid to do the administrative side of the job as opposed to the hands-on practical side?
The benchmarking and the evidence says we are under-managed, but I accept it is a constant rhetoric and theme which keeps being peddled, it's again is inaccurate. It's the same as the inaccurate bed numbers. We are undermanaged. And when we talk about administration, we have a lot of people who are not frontline clinical, but their role absolutely supports the delivery of clinical care. And the example I often give is the MDT coordinators who track and coordinate cancer care and those patients on a cancer pathway, ensuring that clinicians can spend their time with patients. But these are incredibly vital roles. They're not clinicians, but they are supporting frontline delivery. Our administration services who support our consultants, our secretaries, our ward clerks, our discharge coordinators. These are all incredibly important roles that if they weren't there, everything would just slow down and stop. We have put in a new clinically led management structure. We have our nurses, our doctors and our health, allied health professionals are front and centre in our leadership. And even those people who have manager as part of their title are often clinicians with a clinical background. And so I find this quite concerning that there is this view, because when you actually look at it as a benchmarking across the wider NHS and into Europe, we are undermanaged. We have an incredibly lean senior management team, and many of these are required for compliance levels and to demonstrate good quality and safety of an organisation. And so I will continue to speak out on behalf of all of the staff that we have, all of the services we deliver, and all of the very important roles. We have no roles in Manx Care that are not providing the optimum contribution to this system. And as I say, disappointed to still be having to answer questions on that, but happy to keep doing that. It is important, though, that we recognise that good care is still being provided, we will continue to work hard to improve.
Thank you for making it to the end of the Manx Radio newscast. You are obviously someone with exquisite taste. May I politely suggest you might want to subscribe to this and a wide range of Manx Radio podcasts at your favourite podcast provider, so our best bits will magically appear on your smartphone. Thank you.